one splice in the wire. I should have known from the count that I would never clean out 12 miles of telephone line in a day. But now that I was going to quit, I developed a pious feeling, wishing to end in the act of conscientiously performing my duty. So I kept the climbing spurs on and followed the telephone right of way, watching the line dip from tree to tree. When you're following line this way, you lose all sense of the earth, and all that exists is this extended pencil line in your eye. I wouldn't have seen a rattlesnake unless he had wings and was flying south for the winter. As far as I was concerned, there were no rattlesnakes in Elk Summit District. And if there were any, they would be holed up because it was late in the season and it had just snowed. You could have examined my thoughts clear to the bottom of the heap and never found a snake track. I don't need to tell you how a rattlesnake sounds. You can't mistake one. Sometimes you can think that a big-winged grasshopper is a rattlesnake, but you can never think that a rattlesnake is anything else. I stayed in the air long enough to observe him streaking for the brush. An ugly bastard, short, not like a plains rattler, and much thicker behind his head. I don't know how far I jumped, but I was mad when I lit. Mad at myself for jumping so high. I took off my climbing spurs, picked up my axe, and started into the brush after him. I remembered about the crazy sheep herder in the valley, who'd been bitten that summer by a rattler, and, instead of taking it easy and caring for the bite, had chased the rattler until he killed him and himself. I also remember the crew talking about it and saying that even for a sheep herder he must have been crazy. I must have been crazier, because after remembering I went into the brush after him. I went in too fast and couldn't find him. We talk nowadays about a happening, which is a good term to describe the next section of my life. In my mind, it didn't occur successively and can't be separated. The snake was coiled about 4 feet in front of me. I stuck the axe down between him and me. He hit the axe handle. The axe handle rang like a bell that had been struck, and there was no punctuation between any of this. Then time started again, because it was after this happening that I felt my hands sting from holding the axe handle. The way your hands sting when you're a kid holding a baseball bat and not paying any attention, and another kid with a bat comes sneaking up and hits your bat with his. The snake lay there as if he had never left his coil. He whirred and watched. He just barely left the next move up to me, and I made it fast. I almost set a record for a standing backward jump. It was getting so that I was doing most of my thinking in the air. I decided if I got to the ground again, that I would try to take some of the sting out of my hands by chopping a few more fallen trees. But instead, when I lit, I stood frozen, trying to picture the snake as he struck, because part of the picture was missing. All I could recall was about 1.5 feet of his tail end lying on the ground. His head and all his upper part weren't in the picture. Where they should have been was just a vertical glaze. As I backed off farther, I came to the conclusion that 1.5 feet of him stayed on the ground as a platform to strike from, and what struck was too fast to see. The bastard still whirred, so I backed off even farther before I strapped on my climbing spurs. This time, when I started to follow the line, I kept one eye and a good part of another on where I was putting my feet. If you have ever strung much wire, you know there is an important difference between the climbers used on telephone poles and on trees. Tree spurs are about 2 inches longer, because when you're climbing trees, your spurs first have to penetrate the bark before they can start getting any hold in the wood, which is all fine and dandy as long as the trees have bark. But pretty soon the line crossed an old fire burn, maybe one of those 1910 burns, and the only trees standing were long dead and had no bark on them, and were as hard as ebony. I could get only 1/2 inch of spur in them, and so I rocked around on the tips of my spurs and prayed the 1/2 inch would hold. The higher I climbed these petrified trees, the more I prayed. Before long, the line crossed a gulch 250 yards or more wide, and it was natural but tough luck that the line on one side of the gulch was down. A span of 250 yards of No. 9 line is a hell of a lot of weight for a dead tree to hold up in a storm. And one of the trees, rotted at the roots, had come down. I chopped out the line that had got wound around the tree when it fell, and I spliced the line and added a few feet to it and picked a new tree to hang it on. Then I almost left the line lying there and started for the ranger station, because I didn't want to climb a dead tree while carrying that weight of line. But whenever I started to duck out like that, the ranger was sure to be watching. So I put the wire over my climbing belt and the belt around the tree, and started up with my rear end sticking straight out to punch as much spur into that calcified tree as possible. You've seen linemen at work, and know it's a job for rear ends that stick out. And you should know why, even if you've never had climbers on. And when you're hanging line on trees instead of poles, you have an extra hazard to overcome. You have to lean even farther back on your rear end and swing a little axe to chop off the limbs as you go up, because your belt is around that tree, and it has to go up if you are. Also going up with you are at least 250 yards of number 9 wire, getting heavier and tauter every time you stick half an inch of spur into this totem pole of carborundum. Below on the tree are the sharp stubs of branches you've chopped. Less than halfway up, the line had become so taut it would have pulled me out of the tree if I hadn't been strapped to it by the belt. The half inch of spur became less and less. Then I heard the splinter. Maybe I would have felt better if I had had no belt, and the wire just flipped me over the cliff into the gulch. Anyway, with my spurs torn out of the totem pole, I came down about 10 or 12 feet, and then my belt caught on something, and I dangled there and smelled smoke from the front of my shirt, my belly having passed over 10 feet of the snag ends of chopped branches. I worked the belt loose and fell 10 or 12 feet more, and so on. I never could push far enough away from the tree to jab my spurs into it again, and when I finally reached the ground, I felt as if an Indian had started a fire by rubbing two sticks together, using me for one of the sticks. I was afraid to look at my lower quarters to see what was still with me. Instead, I studied the snags of those branches to see which of my private parts were to hang there forever and slowly turn to stone. Finally, I could tell by the total distribution of pain that all of me was still on the same nervous system. I was suddenly destitute of piety, and knew that I had done all the telephone repair work that I was going to do that day. I tried to tie my outfit into one pack, but all I was thinking about was how thick that mountain rattler was behind his head, and how warm I was in front. It was downhill to the ranger station, and I arrived there late in the afternoon, still not altogether cooled off. As I expected, Bill was in the warehouse, and he didn't look up when I came in. He said, "Why'd you leave the peak?" He knew damn well why I came in. He had told me to come in if it snowed. I said, "There are rattlers up there." He grinned and seemed pleased with himself and the snake. I didn't mention anything about tree climbing, although the front of my shirt was torn. He wasn't building packs. He was just pulling things together at the end of the season. We didn't say much of anything to each other because I was sore about the snake and he was enjoying himself. But after a while, we both got our minds on what we were doing, and we both were enjoying ourselves. Maybe one of the chief reasons you become a packer is that you like to handle groceries and tools. By this time in the season, most of the slabs of bacon are moldy, and a lot of the tools have broken handles or need their points or edges sharpened, but that's all right. It's a good feeling to pick up an honest mattock that's lost its edge from chopping roots and rocks while making a fire trench. And moldy bacon gives a feeling of having been more than ready to be of service. Finally, Bill said, "Why do you go back with the trail crew? They've been doing without you, and I need somebody around camp to help me straighten out the stuff now that the season's over." Then he said, as if he had put the two things together in his mind, "How about a game of cribbage at the station tonight?" I said I would if he needed me, and to myself I said I'd put off for a day or two telling him that I was going to quit. More and more I sensed I was slipping out of life and being drawn into a story. I couldn't quit even when it was time to quit. The cribbage I especially wasn't crazy about. Here he was, a big black hat and a blue shirt and a cold Bull Durham cigarette hanging on his lip, and in his logging boots a double tongue with a fancy fringe cut in it. In addition to all this splendor, he was the best packer going, and we thought the best ranger. And he could handle big crews of firefighters as if he personally owned them and the Bitterroot Mountains. And maybe he had killed a sheep herder, and yet he couldn't play cribbage. And if the rumors from Hamilton were true about his poker, he couldn't play cards, and he couldn't keep away from them. But my immediate burden was this two-handed face-to-face cribbage, and I couldn't get anybody in the outfit to join and make a third so we could play something else. I've already told you about the cook turning me down, and you can bet I tried the crew before I tried him. The crew was like nearly every other crew I ever worked with in the woods. They were misers on the job. They wouldn't buy shoelaces as long as they could tie more knots than the old ones. They wouldn't bet a nickel on a card game. They learned to sew great, ugly patches on their shirts. They spent all Sunday darning their socks and patching the patches on their shirts. They hoarded and Christianized, all so they would have a bigger role to lose the first night they hit town. The closer we got to quitting time, of course, the more they hoarded and Christianized. When I went to the crew's tent to find my bedroll and air it before night, I ran into the whole bunch. It was good to see them, especially Mr. Smith, who gave me a thump on the back. But I didn't try to tempt them into any forms of sin like a dime-limit poker game. I knew I was stuck with cribbage, and I could hear Bill counting an 8 and a pair of 7s, 15-2, 15-4, 15-6, and a pair make 8. That evening I learned never to quit hating a guy just because I hadn't seen him for a while. Bill and I were a little guarded with each other, but my 2 weeks in exile had cleaned away some of our bad feelings. Sending me to Siberia, though, hadn't given Bill any greater insight into cards, and I knew that unless we changed the game, we would soon be in trouble again. I'm sure that feeling was right. Where I was wrong was in forgetting to keep on hating the cook. He was almost through wiping the dishes. The food had tasted pretty good, especially after 2 weeks of my own cooking. And three men seemed as if they should be friendly when we had just been through an August snowstorm. As one of those people who often are among the first to hear what they're saying, I heard myself say, overloaded with friendship, "Here, give me a towel and let's finish the dishes. Then how about joining us in a game of something? The season's almost over and the three of us have never sat down to a game." He jerked away the towel I was reaching for. In his canvas shoes, he rose on his toes, sank back on his heels, and rose again. Until this time, I hadn't been old enough to realize that you can't hate a guy without expecting him to return the compliment. Up to now, I thought you could hate somebody as if it were your own business. "How many times do I have to tell you? I don't play cards against guys I work with." The cards lay rejected in my hand. He rolled the towel in a wad and threw it on the dish rack. "Here, give me those cards," he said, and grabbed them out of my hand and sat down at the table and began to shuffle. The cards seemed to burst into flames. He said, "Sit down." And I obeyed, with my hand still open where the cards had been. Then he did two things. First, he flashed through the cards and picked out the four aces. Then he stuck them in the pack. Then he asked me to cut the deck. Then he dealt out hands to Bill, me, and himself. "Turn them over," he said to me. Mine was just a hand. So was Bill's. In his hand were all four aces. He started out the same way the next time. He picked out the four aces, stuck them into the deck, shuffled, had me cut, and then dealt out hands to the three of us. "Turn them over," he said, and there wasn't a single ace in any hand. He slapped the deck of cards in front of me. "Here," he said, "find the four aces," and he went back to finish the dishes. It wasn't like me to be obedient, but I was. I fumbled through the deck and never found an ace. Then I tried to conduct a more thorough search, and then I gave up. As he spread his dish towel to dry, he said over his shoulder, "Look in your shirt pocket." They were there, all four of them. I spread them out to count them. I was to have plenty of reason to remember this trick. "He's a card shark," Bill said, with a smile on his face, something like the smile that was there when I had told him the rattler had almost bit me. After a while, Bill added, "He's an artist." Well, I was a little dazed, I admit, and there was no denying he was a card shark. And in the center circle of male magic sits the card shark. But Bill's calling him an artist was something I wouldn't accept. I said to myself, fortunately not out loud this time, still, there's something wrong with this guy. I still think he's a 40-cent piece. He came over and sat down next to me at the table again and began to shuffle and deal. Now he was only practicing by himself. Usually he dealt one round and said one sentence. If he wanted more emphasis, he would shuffle, cut, and deal four hands and then say one sentence. Something like this. I'll tell you once and for all about my card playing. One round. I play cards for a living. One round. I have to get out in the summer for my health. One round. I can't do hard work because I have to keep my hands soft. One round. So I cook and wash dishes. One round. I practice every night before I go to bed. And he played a whole poker game again before he finished. I never play cards against men I work with. With one movement, he picked up the four hands, and we all started for bed. By the way, Bill said as I went out the door, I have a scheme. I'll tell you about it tomorrow. Before I went to sleep, I had the scheme fairly well figured out. Just fairly well. The truth is that I don't think he had figured it out too well himself at the time. Maybe never. It became obvious as we talked in the warehouse the next morning that he was talking to shape things in his own mind. From the beginning, I was the one to pick up the money, and he would cover me, whatever that meant. At the beginning, too, he thought he would need only two others, and he made what to me was a strange pick. Mr. Smith and a Canadian soldier who had been gassed and had been sent out to recover in the high mountains. Although he wore the first pair of horn-rimmed glasses I ever saw, and with a braided cord attached, he turned out to be almost as gifted in communing with livestock as Bill himself. He could talk to all horses and mules and heal them, no matter what their trouble was. He must have had something for Bill to pick him for the rough work ahead, even though sometimes he coughed so bad that we would take the whiskey away from him and drink it ourselves, on the theory that there was no use wasting fairly good moonshine on a dying man. Bill's picking him had to be a case of one horseman believing in another. At first, then, Bill was going to count on the three of us and himself. But before the morning was over, he had decided on the whole crew. It's a pretty good crew, he said. We can't leave any of them out. As for the cook, I was warned again never to put a hand on him. He estimated that it would take us another week or more to get the station in shape at the end of the season, and to load the pack string, mostly with surplus tools from the big fire. The cook, he said, would ride to Hamilton. The rest of us would walk. No wonder the cook wore low canvas shoes in the woods. The first night in town, we were to meet at the Oxford, pool and card parlor that by report was Hamilton's best. He was betting all his roll on the cook. As for the rest of us, we could get in on a sure thing if we liked, and just as much as we wanted to contribute. That was up to me and to them. Me to tell them, and all of us to contribute. I was told again, several times, that I was to pick up the money in case trouble started, and I was told again that he would cover me. Wear your own gun, too, he said to me. God, I said, Bill, I can't do that. I have nothing but that .32-20 on a .45 frame. That's as big as horse artillery. I'd be arrested before I got to the bar. Well, he said, expect trouble. After a while, I asked, Bill, you don't have any sidearm, do you, but the big .45? Do you think you can get into a gambling joint wearing that? He said, I said, I'll cover you. Early in the morning, I had started putting pieces together by remembering the rumors that in Hamilton, Bill was regarded as nature's gift to the local gamblers. It was said that they even matched to see which one would pluck him when he came to town. So now we were going to have a big melodrama that might be called The Ranger's Revenge. I was to go out and invite the crew to make the stake bigger, so those Hamilton boys who had done Bill in would be done in bigger themselves. And a couple of weeks ago, I had been sent into exile because I said I was going to take a punch at the cook. And when the time came, the cook was going to ride into Hamilton while we walked. Well, I said to myself, it all fits. But I bet $20 on the son of a bitch myself, and normally I hoarded my money just like the rest of them. It took the crew some time to warm up to the idea of staking the cook. To start with, they didn't like the cook much better than I did. Then, too, in the struggle between instincts, it's hard to know whether miserliness or greed will have the edge. The crew still would rather darn their socks than lose a dime, but they couldn't bear to miss a sure thing. Finally, I told them about finding the four aces in my shirt pocket. That's simple to explain, but hard to do, Mr. Smith said. Since he had spent most of his life around mining camps, he knew all about cards, but wasn't much good with them himself and practically never played. He palmed them, he said. What the hell is palming? I asked. He got a card and showed us how you hold the edges of a card between your first finger and your little finger, and then bend your fingers and reach with your thumb and push or pull the card from your palm to the back of your hand, or vice versa, at the same time turning your wrist so the card can't be seen by someone in front of you. So what he did, Mr. Smith said, was to have the cards in the back of his hand and to show you the palm, and as he went by your shirt pocket, he bent his fingers and put the cards in it. He tried to show us, but he was clumsy, and we could always see the card, though we got the idea. We all tried to palm, but we were clumsier than Mr. Smith. In fact, I tried for several years to get fairly good, but never did. Mr. Smith said to convince us, "You've seen this in vaudeville." In those days, the Pantages circuit made the rounds of Spokane, Butte, and Missoula. So we had all seen a magician hold out a card in his palm and then toss it in the air where it disappeared. "Do you mean," Mr. McBride asked, "Cook is good enough to be in vaudeville?" "He might be," said Mr. Smith. "Here we're just trying to palm one card, but he may have palmed all those four aces at once." Someone reverently said, "Jesus." And they all bet. Besides, they, too, began to get the feeling that they were all to have parts in a sort of pulp magazine plot, and they liked the feeling. If they seemed to feel a lot better than I did about having a part in the story, maybe that was because they liked their part better than I thought I was going to like mine. Anyway, when I collected the hat pool, it turned out the average bet was more than what I had bet, even a little more than half a month's wages. Once their bets became official by my handing over their money to Bill, they gathered every night to see the cook shuffle, peering in a semicircle around the table like a bunch of railbirds at a racetrack, watching their favorite horse work out. Now that they had bet on him, they even spoke of having a piece of him. Although, as Bill had suggested, I was working around the station and not with the trail crew, I knew that they weren't getting much done either. For them, as for me, quitting time had come, and we were all through for the season. It wasn't only because we felt carried away by being in our own story. Anyone who has done seasonal work knows that as regular as the seasons themselves is the return of this feeling at the end of each season. It's time to quit. It's time to quit. Even Mr. Smith seemed to have lost his passion for dynamite. We started trying to have some fun, more or less getting in practice for the first night in town. Now, I know that it's common to picture loggers and cowboys as always whooping it up, full of bad whiskey and great jokes on greenhorns. I don't know much about cowboys. They come from my wife's country. But before I was through, I worked with a lot of crews in the woods, and day in and day out, we weren't jokey. And jokes on greenhorns were pretty standardized. For one thing, we worked too hard and too long to be left bubbling over with a comic spirit. For another thing, we worked too often alone or in small groups to think it worth the time to be funny. It's no trouble at all to be tragic when you're tired and alone, but to be funny, you have to be fresh, and you have to have time on your hands, and you have to have an audience, and you have to be funny. And however much you may love the woods, you can't claim it is full of natural wits. Don't get me wrong, we had what we called our fun, but only on what seemed like state occasions. And often then our jokes were pretty much the same old jokes, and often the laugh was on us at the end. A state occasion was when a big crew got together, especially if it was quitting time and no one was working hard anymore. Even so, we began very gently to throw off our working man's puritanism and prepare for sin. We began with a crew from the engineers that had camped at the ranger station for a few days. They were mapping the backcountry where, they said, the government hadn't figured out yet what they'd stolen from the Indians. I went over to see them right away because I liked maps and what they stood for. But the rest of our bunch were slower to take an interest in this mapping crew. For one thing, they waited every night until the cook had finished shuffling cards. And for another, they had the practical woodsman's distrust of Forest Service maps. They were convinced that a lot of the backcountry was mapped, in those early days, by guys who sat in tents or in the regional office in Missoula in the winter and said, "No, it goes here." In fact, in those early days, we never believed that a mountain was really there unless it had been located by the United States Geological Survey. So our bunch immediately got in an argument with a mapping crew. We pretended to ourselves that we were the regional office in Missoula. "Hell," we would say, "that creek doesn't go there, it goes here." Sometimes we were only trying to confuse them, and sometimes we meant it. At that time, though, the mapping crew was more troubled about the name of a creek than where it went. They had been over on the North Fork of the Clearwater, and of course had run into Wet Ass Creek. They had accurately located it, too. They may have compassed and chained it. At least they had compassed and paced it. But they were divided as to whether they should put down its real name on the map they were going to submit to the drafting room of the regional office. Well, the regional office has never cared much for jokes or poetry, so we sided loudly with those who were for its right name, and argued that too much of the West had been named after some guy's hometown in Minnesota or Massachusetts, or even after the guy himself, or after a bear or a deer. There are only 5,000 deer creeks in the country. Let's keep America's only wet-ass creek, we argued. The other bunch, who also would soon be spending a summer of money on a night with the whores of Hamilton, argued that many who worked in the Forest Service's drafting room in Missoula were women and would be offended by having to copy such language with their own pure hands. We put it to a vote, and our side won, or for the time being we thought we had. Anyway, they all agreed to submitting its right name to the drafting room, and we looked forward to its becoming a national park. Wet-ass National Park, where all pilgrims from Brooklyn can stop their cars in the middle of the road to let their children feed the grizzlies, and vice versa. In the end, though, it turned out the joke was on us. On the next map of the forest, it appeared all as one word, and a final E had been added, which henceforward was pronounced, and the A was made in Boston. Now, it doesn't mean anything, but be sure you pronounce it right. Wetasee Creek, just as if its headwaters were on Beacon Hill. At the time, we liked our joke, and on the temporary strength of it, tried others. But we were end of summer tired, for that matter still tired from the big fire, and our jokes were tired, too. We even tried to take the Canadian on a snipe hunt, and get him to hold the gunny sack open while we herded the snipe into it. But the Canadian hadn't been gassed in France just to get caught holding a gunny sack in Idaho. Besides, we were starting to get in practice for Hamilton, and we weren't thinking of making jokes when we got there. Instead, the crew had a still back in the woods and were making moonshine out of dried apricots, peaches, and prunes they stole from the warehouse. Old Mr. Smith had got hold of some sterno, and they would boil the pink stuff off the top and drink the rest, and it would go right through them, sometimes before they could get to the toilet or to the brush. They were practicing up for Hamilton, and had a couple of days more to go. I decided I was going to leave next morning and walk to Hamilton in one day and more or less set a record. So I wasn't drinking any of their stuff, not even their dried apricot brandy distilled in a lard pail. When I told them I was going to leave tomorrow, they said, "What the hell kind of guy are you, anyway? Aren't you going to stay with the crew and help us clean out the town? What about the cook winning all that money for us from those Hamilton tin horn gamblers? What kind of a crew are we, anyway, if we don't clean out the town?" All these were important matters, and you can be sure I'd thought about them. You just weren't a crew if you didn't clean out the town as your final act of the season. I don't know why, but it always happens if you're any good, and even if you're not much good, that when you work outside of town for a couple of months, you get feeling a lot better than the town, and very hostile toward it. The town doesn't even know about you, but you think and talk a lot about it. Old Mr. Smith would take another drink of that alcohol and other debris from the canned heat and say, "We'll take that goddamn town apart." Then, with his dignity lost, he would have to run for the toilet, yelling as he ran that we had to show them there were no guys as tough as those who worked for the USFS. Besides, there was this big killing the cook was going to make for us. We spent part of every evening arguing about how much we'd win. The amounts varied depending upon whether we argued before or after we saw the cook deal. But we usually settled for a figure around what for each of us was a summer's wages. Secretly, we hoped for more. But I was out to set a record. Ever since the ranger had realized that the cook was fancy with the cards, and so had taken my place as his favorite, I'd felt a growing need to set a record. I wished that it could be in packing, and that I could become known overnight as one of the Decker brothers, who had designed the latest pack saddle. But I couldn't live long in that pipe dream, and powder work made me sick, so it had to be walking. I knew I could outwalk anyone in our district, and at the moment, I needed a little local fame, and I needed it bad. 28 miles from Elk Summit to the mouth of Blodgett Canyon, plus a few more miles to Hamilton, is not outstanding distance just as distance, but still, it is a damn tough walk. For one thing, those were Forest Service miles. In case you aren't familiar with a Forest Service mile, I'll give you a modern, well-marked example. Our family cabin is near the Mission Glaciers, and naturally one of the many nearby lakes is named Glacier Lake, which is at the end of the Craft Creek Road, except that the final pitch is so steep you have to make it on foot. Where the trail starts, there is a Forest Service sign reading, "Glacier Lake, 1 mile." Then you climb quite a way on the trail toward Glacier Lake, and you come to another Forest Service sign reading, "Glacier Lake, 1.2 miles. So a good working definition of a Forest Service mile is quite a way plus a mile and two-tenths. And I was going to walk over 30 Forest Service miles to Hamilton, about half of them up until I was above mountain goats, and the other half down and down until my legs would beg to start climbing again and I wouldn't be able to comply. The trail was full of granite boulders, and I would manage somehow so that Bill would hear that I had walked it in a day. I said to Bill while he was counting his cribbage hand with his lips, "When are you going to take the pack string and the men into town?" He finished counting before he said, "You will wait till we get there." I didn't know whether he had asked or told me something. I picked up his hand and counted it over again. "I need the whole crew," he said. I said, "Yes." "If you'll stay tomorrow," he said, "and help put the packs together, I'll try to get away by noon the next day and camp on the divide that night. You can start the same morning ahead of us." It was Wednesday, and by his scheme, we would work Thursday, and I would start Friday morning, and he and the men Friday noon. "I'll meet you in town on Saturday," I said. "Saturday night in Hamilton," he said, which was to become one of my walking tunes. Long before daylight, I was using my feet like beetle feelers, find my way across Horse Heaven Meadow. Don't look at me, look at the map, because I don't have the kind of a mind that would come up with a name like that. Even if you want to drop the Horse Heaven business, you still have a high mountain meadow just before daybreak, full of snorts and spooks. There are lots of horses out there, but also a lot of other big animals. Elk and deer, for sure. Maybe bear. They wake in darkness and come down from the hills to drink, and then slowly feed toward higher ground until it gets hot and it's time for them to lie down again. A clank in the darkness is the scariest of all sounds. But you know, a second afterwards, it has to be a hobbled horse. If you're listening for dainty sounds to signify deer, there's nothing daintier than a snort. But there are deer there. They snort and then bound. Elk snort and then crash. Bear bolts straight uphill in a landslide. No animal has such pistons for hindquarters. I still walked in Wonderland after daylight. Far ahead on gray cliffs, I could see the white specks that were not spots in my eyes. The trail was already getting steep, and I knew before noon I would be higher than the mountain goats. And from experience, I knew that there is nothing much higher on Earth. The first summer I worked in the Forest Service, we had come out of Idaho over the Bitterroots by way of Lake Como. And the hunting season on mountain goats was open in Idaho, but not in Montana. And also in those days, we could buy a residence license in Idaho if we worked for the Forest Service. So we all did, and camped for a few days near the divide to hunt. Bill said to me, "All you have to do is get above mountain goats. They never think anything is above them." So all I had to do was get above mountain goats, which is beyond where most men have been. But finally, there was a goat standing below me near the edge of a cliff, 250 or so yards away. I knew that when you shoot downhill at such an angle, you have to shoot way under your target. But it was almost straight down, and I didn't hold under him nearly enough. My bullet didn't even hit the cliff. It was just a loud sound, bound for eternity. The goat only hightailed it behind a rock and hid. Now nobody could see him from below, but he was still in plain sight to me. So Bill had been right. And I thought afterwards it must be great to live believing that there is no danger from above. None of those goats could have been Presbyterians or ever heard my father preach. This time, though, I held so far under him I was afraid I'd shoot my feet off, and I still shot over him. But I did hit the rock, and I've often wondered where the bullet went from there. Likewise, the goat, which may never again have been seen by man. I didn't get any more shots that season. Man is evidently not entitled to miss a goat more than twice in the same year. I walked head down because I wasn't getting anywhere when I watched. So I was aware of him first as a snort and then a stamp. He was in the trail in front of me, and he was a big bull moose, and he looked as if he had decided not to go anyplace. When you saw bull moose in Montana in those days, you were probably near the Bitterroot Divide, and close to one of those snowbank lakes left in the burrows of old glaciers. This bull lowered his horns and then, possibly just for exercise, raised them. Some half-chewed marsh grass stuck out of his mouth. Finally, he reversed the order and stamped and then snorted. Reluctantly, he turned and started down the trail, slowly at first, but faster as he went along, as if the idea of retreating came very gradually to him. I watched those legs swinging those big feet that looked as if they had been shod, and I am almost sure he was a four-gated animal, if you'll admit that for a short stretch I saw him single-foot. In Wonderland, why shouldn't a moose single-foot as well as walk, trot, and pace? Then I put my head down and started my one and only gait again. There was nothing but granite now, and as it became hard to climb and breathe, I needed somebody besides Bill to watch me. I began to think about my girl, and finally she appeared to me, as if her image had been resting in the woods with the deer. Since my father was the Presbyterian minister in town, I had lived quite a few years under the impression that Roman Catholic girls were prettier than Protestant girls. About Jewish girls, I was of a divided mind, probably because there were just two Jewish girls in my hometown, one for each half of my mind. One was classy and played the piano and was several years older than I was and wouldn't even look my way. The other was younger than I was and ugly and would do anything to please me. She even made dates for me with other girls she thought I'd like. She had started me going with my present Irish Catholic girl, whose particular fascination was a deep scar in her forehead that half-closed a corner of her eye and made her look as if she was never quite looking at me. I discovered several years later that she had been screwing everybody in town, except me and possibly several other Protestants. And after that discovery, I veered rapidly to red and black-headed Protestant and Jewish girls. But at the time, I conceived of her as my one and only. She watched me out of her deceptive eye, I thought admiringly, and I tore up the trail. When I finally made the divide, I carefully studied the center of it, traced in my mind what I designated as the state line between Idaho and Montana, and then made a small section of it real by pissing on it. A very short, dehydrated state line. I always did this on big divides, especially on the Continental Divide, where one is left wondering whether he is going to drain into the Atlantic or the Pacific. The divide here is not the Continental Divide, but it stirs the imagination. Then I sat down and rested above the white goats. I looked back where I had worked 3 summers, and it looked strange. When you look back at where you have been, it often seems as if you have never been there, or even as if there were no such place. Of the peaks in the sky, my old lookout Grave Peak, of course, was the one I knew best. When I lived on it, it was a hard climb out of a basin full of big rocks and small grubs, a tent with a finely mended hole, trees decapitated by lightning, no soft place to sit, and 1 grizzly and 1 rattlesnake. But here from the divide was another reality. It was sculpture in the sky, devoid of any detail of life. There's a peak near my hometown we call Squaw's Teat. It is not a great mountain, but it has the right name for Grave Peak when viewed from the distance of the divide. From the divide, the mountain I had lived on was bronze sculpture. It was all shape with nothing on it, just nothing. It was just color and shape and sky. It was as if some Indian beauty, before falling asleep forever, had decided to leave exposed what she thought was not quite her most beautiful part. So perhaps at a certain perspective, what we leave behind is often wonderland, always different from what it was and generally more beautiful. I was trying to keep from myself the fact that I had walked to the top too fast and was a lot tireder than I wanted to be. I had walked those 14 miles to the rhythm of, "It's time to quit, it's time to quit." But the tempo kept speeding up, especially after my girl began to watch me with a half-closed eye. Sitting there in the sun, I began to feel chilled, so I crossed the divide and looked down Blodgett Canyon to see what it was like ahead. You might never have heard the word geology, and yet have known, the instant you looked down Blodgett Canyon, that you were looking at a gigantic glacial classic. For thousands of years, it must have been a monster of ice, hissing in the cracks of mountains. Coming at me from almost straight below was a Jacob's Ladder of switchbacks, rising out of what I later discovered geologists call a cirque, but what to me looked like the original nest of a green, coiled glacier. When it struck for the valley, the mountains had split apart. At the top, where it writhed out of its course and returned, it left a peak or a series of pinnacles. When it reached its own mouth, the partially digested remains of mountains rolled out of its gorge all the way to the river. It was a big world, and not a very big boy, and I thought it was time he shoved off, even though he hadn't taken a long enough rest. I shook myself to get warm and started down the switchbacks. I'd intended to take it easy in getting started again, but going down switchbacks doesn't give you much choice. And when you're young and out to set a local record, you aren't going to take the long way around each switchback. Wherever the face of the mountain was open, I cut straight down, omitting all 6% grades. I descended in avalanches. Avalanches beside me, avalanches in the rear of me, avalanches in front of me. On the fly, I watched over my shoulder to duck the big boulders. When my legs felt torn in front and I had to stop, I could hear rivulets of granite particles pursuing me and then giving up and then making one more try. After I hit the bottom of the basin and had been standing there for some time to let the spasms in my legs quiet, and even after all the avalanches behind had come to a rest, One big granite chunk dropped from nowhere beside me. I looked up and could find no likely place but the middle of the sky. At the bottom of the basin, I was already lower than the white specks on the cliffs. On the cliffs, there was only an occasional tree where a bird had dropped a seed in a crevice. At the top of the divide, I had felt chilled in the sun. Here, at the bottom of the glacial basin, my face was tightened with heat. Accompanied by avalanches from the sky, I had descended into the pit. The heat made one gigantic bounce from the solar system to the granite cliffs to me personally. Besides, it rose from what I walked on, and I could feel that I was turning black under my face, like Dante descending into the inferno. I had also made myself into something of a medical problem by refusing to drink water. Since I'd never before walked this far in a day and didn't want anybody to know until I was sure I had, I took over all the thinking myself. I thought, when I go fishing on the Blackfoot River and it's hot and I start drinking from the river, pretty soon I can't stop drinking, and pretty soon it doesn't even taste good, and I end up waterlogged and half sick. I reasoned, you mustn't get sick, so you mustn't drink water. I can remember taking a sip when eating my sandwich, and although I can't remember, I must have taken a few other sips. But I stood pledged to some kind of youthful and lofty denial of the flesh. I walked suffering all afternoon down that chasm where mountains had cried for centuries as their structure cracked. At the end, I walked in semi-darkness, medically dehydrated. For irony, a plunging stream accompanied me to the divide, and another one followed me down. Lodget Creek had started at the bottom of the basin, right beside where I and the big boulder lit. Springs all over, with green sponges around them. I took off my woolen socks and waded in one of them to restore firmness to the flesh I walked on. The water was so cold my heart did something funny, so I stepped back on the sponge. On my way down the canyon, I stopped several times to wade in the creek. I watched little black trout who lived and breathed in it, but I fought, nobly I judged, not to take a drink of it myself. I tried to think of various things, but by the time I was halfway down the canyon, I could think of nothing but drinking. I had pictured myself reaching across the green table for all those dollars, but my pressure on the dollars weakened and I felt them slip slowly out of my hands. The man in the tall black Stetson that I wanted to be like had from time to time said to me, "And I'll cover you," but I still didn't know what he meant. I couldn't even retain my girl as part of my mental life. She watched me until she was just her half-closed eye, and then, as some years later, she gave me the big wink and was gone. From time to time I thought I was on the fire line, and that the sky was swirling with burning cones, and that the universe was upside down, with hell above. The trail ahead seemed full of light ashes rising off the ground because I drew near them. At other times I felt sick, and immediately afterwards thought I smelled dynamite. But always I wanted a drink. I knew as a logger I should want a boiler maker, a slug of whiskey with a bottle of beer as a chaser. Instead, I wanted an ice cream soda. I told myself that ice cream sodas were for kids, but the image of a boilermaker left scars of dehydration. Besides, I liked ice cream sodas, and at 17 was secretly curious how men could like the taste of whiskey. So I walked mile after mile with nothing in sight but ice cream sodas that changed only to vary the color combinations. White vanilla, yellow lemon, and brown chocolate were my favorites, but once in a while I stuck in a strawberry flavor just before chocolate. I filled the glasses nearly to the top with carbonated water, leaving not quite enough room for a dip of ice cream so that froth would run over. I drank all the ice cream sodas I could make, always beginning by licking off the froth. I was a damn mess and childish, a fact I tried to keep for myself. When I finally saw the light from the canyon's mouth, the cliff on the north side looked tipped beyond 90 degrees. Even so, I wouldn't have been in too bad shape when I reached Hamilton, if Hamilton had been where I remembered it was, a mile or two from the mouth of Blodgett Canyon. But after one good look, I had to stop to absorb my disbelief. Hamilton is way out in the valley and upriver, and must be 5 or 6 miles from the mouth of the canyon. 5 or 6 miles, all gently sloping to the river, may be a breeze to you, but I sat by the side of the road and played mumbledy-peg to steady my hands. I thought of the Bible, and hoped that a pair of arms would enfold me and put me on a mule and lead me into Hamilton without any more thorns. There it was, in plain view, but farther away than seemed possible for a man to walk. This was the first time I had ever been in a fight when I took a terrible beating at the end. At 17, I had been in a fair number of fights, and had won most of them, and naturally had lost some, too. But always before, when I was losing, some big friend who maybe I hadn't seen before would step in and stop the fight. I had never before taken a beating with nobody there to stop the beating. When you're watching a fight, and you see a guy's legs buckle, and his hands drop, and he doesn't even back away, it's easy to say to another bystander, "Look at that gutless son of a bitch. He won't even put up his hands to fight." It's different, though, when you're the guy with nothing left in your legs that will put up your hands or back away. I didn't try any of the hard positions in mumbledy-peg. Nothing harder than to the nose and to both ears. It helped, though, and gradually I figured out why I was here and Hamilton was way out there. In the spring, our crew had been taken by truck from Hamilton to the mouth of Blodgett Canyon as a start on our way to Idaho. In a truck, what's the difference between a couple of miles and 5 or 6? In the spring, too, I hadn't looked back down Blodgett Canyon to see how a glacier had made it and shoved its remains all the way to the river. Hamilton was on the river, and now I understood why I had 4 or 5 miles yet to go. With that out of the way, I got up and snapped my jackknife shut and began to walk. Sometimes all you have left to win with is the knowledge of why you're taking the beating, and the realization that nobody else is going to save you from it. Since it never got closer while I watched, I didn't look until it was there. I have always been grateful to Hamilton for being, if not where I expected, at least where I could understand. At the time, I was also grateful to Hamilton for being an outwardly simple structure to comprehend after a long day. The road from Blodgett Canyon turns at right angles and joins the main street. And the main street of Hamilton is called Main Street, and the streets that cross it at right angles are named by number. I walked down Main Street to, I think, the block between 3rd and 2nd, where there was a drugstore. I had 2 ice cream sodas, a white vanilla and a yellow lemon, and ordered a 3rd, a chocolate soda, to complete my favorite color sequence. But the drugstore clerk said, "Son, I don't think you should have another one now." I felt like going around behind the counter and shoving the drugstore clerk into his chocolate ice cream freezer, especially for calling me son. But I did.